interested in the trainings of the young Guardians Padawans you are, come to the right place. You have Guardians of the Future. This is your host. I am Justin Latta. What's up, everybody? This is Guardians of the Future. I am Justin Ladd. If you didn't get that reference off the bat, you're not watching on YouTube. I have my lightsaber. If you haven't checked your calendar, what it was over the weekend, it was my best attempt at a pop culture influence there. If you don't get that reference, I don't know. We can't be friends. Please look it up if you don't understand the reference to that one. But this is Guardians of the Future. I am Justin Ladd. I'm sorry to take last week off. I had a lot of stuff going on work-wise and personal-wise, so I do have a lot of stuff I do want to get to on this week's episode. I'm still talking to people about some other guest appearances, but want to go over some things this week. And let's start off with the biggest news, of course, and that is that Kyle Manzardo is arriving to the Guardians finally. Everybody has been waiting for this for, you know, since the start of last season, or the end of last season when he went to the AFL and really crushed it, and or even when they had traded for him last year. It's exciting news, no doubt. People have been waiting for this. And I think the reason it took so long, look, I had a lot of people online trying to explain to me that, oh, it's the Dolans, they're being cheap, yada, yada, yada. Kyle Manzardo is never going to cost this team a lot in arbitration. So playing Super 2 with him didn't really make a lot of sense, because as a first baseman, he is not going to be Pete Alonso. He is not going to be Vlad Guerrero Jr., although Guerrero's not really having the best of times. He's not going to be Matt Olson, okay? He's not going to be a generational high-value first baseman. We're not talking about the Freddie Freemans, even Josh Naylor makes a ton of money. That might be as far as Manzardo goes, you know, but he's not going to be an Olson or an Alonso. That's what we can say there. Not a guy who's going to challenge for 40 home runs. But that doesn't mean he's not going to be a good prospect, and it doesn't mean he's not going to be good when he comes up. My expectations early on for Manzardo, and first of all, the reason he wasn't up wasn't due to arbitration, it was because the Guardians have a terribly, I shouldn't say terrible, terrible is the wrong word. They have a very mismanaged roster. It's not a terrible roster, because obviously they're in first place, and they've got guys who are doing things well. Like, I still like Will Brennan. Florial's been interesting. They need to figure out what's going on with Freeman. They need to see Arias a lot more still, and they still need to see Rocchio. So David Fry has a spot in that roster. So it made it hard to plug in Manzardo. If Manzardo played outfield, this would have been a no-brainer. He probably made the team out of camp, honestly, because he deserved it. But he's not an outfielder, and they had other young guys they needed to see. So that played into why he wasn't up already, as opposed to, you know, playing Super 2 games. Now, service time is one thing, although, you know, Manzardo is going to be 30 when he reaches free agency. That's not a particularly valuable age for first baseman, so I don't know if the Guardians necessarily, really give a crap in terms of what that looks like. When it comes to his payday, either way, it doesn't matter. I don't think they're playing those games with him. But he's up now, and, you know, it does unfortunately come at the cost of Stephen Kwan. What are you going to do? That's life. These things do happen, and they always work themselves out, you know, the way they always do, as we always talk about on Locked On Guardians. So my guess for Manzardo is he is going to play – he's going to DH probably, first of all. I think Naylor – I haven't looked at the metrics this year. I think Naylor's been a fine defender overall this year. He was good last year. Manzardo – you know, is kind of fringe average as a defender there. I don't think he's going to be anything special. I definitely don't anticipate him winning any gold gloves, but I would anticipate him DHing, maybe getting him to play first base a little bit too, because obviously DHing is hard because you're kind of thinking about your at-bats a lot, which can be good and bad. Some guys don't like to DH as much because it gets in their head and all you're doing is thinking about your at-bats, whereas if you're in the field, you got other things to think about, it can kind of
keep your brain moving, keep you into the game, and maybe compound things a little bit less. But I think they'll ease him in. I would not expect him to play against lefties at first. Maybe he will. Maybe they'll give him a shot right away just to see. But, you know, he does have two of his 9 home runs in AAA this year against lefties. They both home runs off lefties came this past week with against Toledo. They weren't necessarily great lefties, but they're okay. And, you know, it's better than he's done in years past, so it doesn't really matter who he came off of, because in the past, Manzaro has struggled against left-handers very badly to the point where he's hit under 200. So I do anticipate that being an issue at the major league level for him. He's got a bit of a hole at the top of the zone, at least up and in, I think, and up and over the middle of the plate on getting the balls. I do think he has kind of a swing that's designed to take advantage of stuff in the middle of the zone, obviously, like all hitters do. And I think he can hit everything in the lower half of the zone. And I think he can cover the outer half of the zone as well, for the most part. The home run he did off a lefty on Saturday, he took the other way. And I think that ball, I said on Twitter, would have been off the wall in Cleveland. It would have been a home run, but it probably would have been off the wall. And it was a good approach to take. So I think he'll be able to do that kind of stuff. He's got a good eye at the plate. He's a tad bit passive. One way I look at that is I mean, I've watched the games too, but so on Fangraphs, he's got a 6.9 swinging strike rate and his strikeout rate is 17.2. The sort of rule of thumb there is you can double that strikeout rate, and that's kind of, or that swinging strike rate, and that's what you can get on your strikeout rate. Now it's not, you know, exact science. You can give or take a few in either direction. So you would expect him to have about a 14% strikeout rate. And it's about 17, so that's probably within the error bars, honestly. But there is a little bit of passivity there, so I do expect him to potentially take some stuff on the zone that's not, you know, because he just hasn't seen it. Major league pitching, I can't stress this enough. Pitching at the major league level, there is such a massive gap right now between AAA and the majors, because anymore teams are using it as a holding pen for depth, which makes a ton of sense, right? You have less prospects at AAA. Which has been the case for a while now. Double A has great prospects, and then they get the Triple A. Then your best players are the major leagues, really. So you're just not getting a ton of top echelon prospects in Triple A. You get a few here and there on their way there when they first get called up, things like that. But there's just a gap right now between the majors and Triple A. So whatever he's facing at Triple A, the pitching just isn't going to be the same. Things don't always translate 1-to-1. Like, he's carrying 11% walk rate, which is consistent with where he's been throughout his career so far, and then that range. I would expect it to be more like, you know, 9-8% in the majors, maybe 10. Maybe it'll be higher because he's going to be passive. I don't know. It's going to be tough at first. I expect it to be tough. I'm just trying to set, you know, realistic expectations for the kid. I do think he's got a good hit tool. I know that's always a conflated statement. Like, people talk about guys' hit tools all the time. And, like, people were years ago putting like a 70 grade hit tool on, like, guys like Ernie Clement, and, you know, even like Stephen Kwan got an 80 hit tool from one place, which I don't think is very accurate, because putting the ball down on the ball doesn't make you a good hitter. It means you don't strike out. That doesn't mean you're a good hitter. Quality of contact has to come into play here. And why I think Manzardo has a good hit tool is because he makes the right kind of contact. Now, does he hit the ball particularly hard? No. His exit velocities are probably average. They're not bad. They're not elite for a guy who's a power hitter. If he was playing shortstop or center field, we would look at these and be like, this is great. But as a first baseman, you definitely want more power in terms of raw. And I don't think he has that. I think he's probably got average raw power overall. Maybe not for a first baseman, maybe in general. Like, average raw power for a first baseman is probably 30 home runs, you know, it's a high bar to clear, right? But what Manzardo does to me is he hits the ball hard enough, and he hits the ball in the air, and he pulls it. He has always been able to hit the ball in the air and pull it. That has always been a strength of his game. And I'm not going to sit here and compare anyone to Jose Ramirez, because we always do this. Anytime somebody says, oh, this guy pulls the ball and hits it in the air, you know, it's like Jose Ramirez. It is. But, you know, Elevate and Celebrate has been a revolution for a while now. And it's pulling the ball in the air. We know Isaac Paredes from Tampa Bay, or anybody on Tampa Bay, really. That's the most maximizing route to get the most out of your hitters. And to me, that's why Manzardo is going to work as a first baseman. Like, again, I'm not saying he's going to be Matt Olson. He's not going to be Pete Alonso. I don't think he is, because those guys have incredible raw power. They always did. But Manzardo is going to make contact enough, because he can make contact. I think he's going to strike out at a 24% clip in the end. Not going to say right away because those things can fluctuate. And then I think he's going to walk at a decent rate. It's not going to be anything crazy special, but it should be pretty good. And I think he can hit 25 homers. I think he can hit 25 doubles. I think 25 home runs might be the peak. But why I think he can do it is because he makes enough contact and he gets the ball in the air to the pole side. And that's how you maximize your hip tool, because when you are your power too, because when you're a guy who doesn't hit for great raw power, you've got to be able to do those things right. And he does those things right. And, you know, until he hits lefties, maybe that's a little more limited. So maybe saying 25 home runs is a little bit unrealistic. I think out of the gate, maybe it's 18-20. I do think he has extra base power. We'll see what he does against lefties. I don't know what changes he's made to improve against them. You know, Josh Naylor did it. You know, he was able to find a way to do it. Maybe Manzardo will. Maybe he'll pick that up from Naylor. I'm not sure. I would expect him to sit against lefties. Maybe they'll give him some chances here and there when his confidence is going good. We'll see. I'm excited to see him. I think he's a good prospect. He is my top prospect in the system, just because I believe in the overall profile of the bat. You know, he's not going to add anything speed-wise. He's not going to add a whole lot in the field. He's not a 40 home run hitter, which is usually what a 30 home run hitter from first base. You know, that's what you want. But I think he can be an above league average hitter. We're talking a guy who can put up a 120, 125 WRC plus. You know, however he gets there doesn't matter. As long as you are above league average hitting, you definitely want the bar to be higher. You want to clear the higher bar at first base. And if you're not adding, you know, base running to your game, if you're not adding defense to your game, the bat has to do all the talking. So you're probably not going to get, like, you know, a lot of high war seasons from Manzardo. 2.5, you know, maybe. But it doesn't matter in the end. I just want a guy who can hit it in this position. And I think he can do that. It's just a different way of getting there. I don't know if I'm not going to sit here and, you know, claim all-star teams, all that kind of stuff. I think he can be a good hitter in time. And he's ready. I think he's ready. He deserves a spot. It just stinks that it came at the expense of Kwan, and there was not really a fit for him to begin with. There is now, because you can move some of those guys. They were DHing with the outfield, but, you know, he's here. Unfortunately, a guy who is not going to be here for a little bit is Chase DeLauder. And I tried to caution people in spring training. Everybody wanted this guy on the team out of spring training, and A, that was unrealistic, but B, to think he was going to be up this year, at least early, was a little crazy, I think, at all, really, because if he would have completed this season healthy, it would have been his first full season of baseball healthy since, like, I don't know, 2021. That's how long it's been for DeLauder since he's been really healthy. 2023. Maybe 2022 was the year he was healthy. I'm sorry, not 2021. You know, he played in the Cape in 2022. The Guardians drafted him in 2022. So 2021 was the last season he was fully healthy, where he played in college, he played in the Cape, got hurt in 2022, the Guardians drafted him, he didn't play for the first half of last year, and then he was great when he came on, he was great in high A, and he was good in the Arizona Fall League, and now he has the foot fracture again, and the same surgically repaired foot. That's a tough injury, and he was off to a really slow start so far, and I know people were trying to say, like, oh, well, if he's had this nagging injury, it's causing a slow start, time to sit him down anyway. That wasn't the case. He was healthy until he made that run to catch the fly ball in the outfield. And he didn't get there and came up a little gingerly. I'm not sure what happened, but feet are tough. Generally more of a problem with big NBA guys. Like, you've seen Zydrunas Ilgauskas have that issue. Yao Ming have those repeated foot issues. That hampered them. You know, those guys were both good players. Obviously, Yao Ming was in a different category, and this is a different sport, but those guys were good players, but they really struggle with those injuries. I hope it isn't the case for DeLauder. I hope he's going to be okay. I looked up the fracture, like the name of the fracture, all that kind of stuff, and I found whatever on Google, but as we know, the one thing you shouldn't do ever is Google medical stuff, because it just takes you down a bad road, and I'm not going to listen to advice on there, because I mean, everybody can Google it all they want, but we don't have the medical data that's being accessed on DeLauder right now, so who knows? I would imagine it's going to be not a short-term injury. If it's a fracture, it's probably going to be at least a month of not playing, so that takes him out all the month of May. it's such a risk keeping him on the field. Hopefully this thing works itself out. You know, I had concerns about the health. I had concerns about whether or not he was going to, that's, everyone had concerns with the swing working or not. And all this does is being off the field is take away time from him being able to work on that swing and make it work against pitching prospects in the minors. So we can see how it, you know, how it's going to play. It's tough. And I mean, I'd imagine this is going to make I think it was unrealistic he was going to make it up this year anyway, truthfully, unless he really, really was hitting the crap out of the ball at every level and there was nobody above him even holding down the job. I think next year was more likely. Next year still could be likely. But again, the next season that Chase Lauder finishes a full season without injury will be his first since 2021. It's just been a while. It's unfortunate. It stinks. You know, I think he's a very talented player. A lot of people do. And I think he can be a good average regular at the worst, a good platoon hitter in the outfield. I think that, as weird as the swing is, I think it can work. It's worked for him. You know, there were things in spring training that made me think that, you know, it's going to be better than I thought, but we'll see. But the best availability is, you know, availability. So he doesn't have that right now. And until he has that, it's going to be an issue. Can't sit there and get the reps at AA that you need. You can't work on things if you're sitting in the dugout in a walking boot. It just is what it is. It's unfortunate for him. Wish the best for him to get healthy, and because he's a talented player, I think he's a good kid. And these foot injuries can be reoccurring, so I hope they find a way to get past them at some point. Guys that are back in action, talking about availability, George Valera came back finally after his hamstring injury last week. He played in 3 games. He doubled and walked in his first game, and then he homered on Sunday, which was good to see. The stance looks a little bit more narrow. He was very wide, had a very wide base previously, and they kind of narrowed that up a little bit. Maybe they were hoping to reduce some strain on his legs or his calves or his hammies. I don't know, but that's a guy who is out of options at the end of the year, and he needs to make some noise this year, and Cleveland needs to feel the pressure to call him up. Because next year he's out of options. If you do not see him in the majors this year and you go into spring training next year and you know, he has to make the team or you have to option him down, you have to trade him, that puts everybody in a bad spot. And the worst thing that could happen here is, you know, Valera doesn't do enough to earn a call up this year or whatever. And he goes into camp next year and he, you know, is spring training, right? And the Guardians decide, well, this isn't going to work. And they trade him to God knows where, Tampa Bay. And because they're out of options on him and they just didn't see a future here. And he goes somewhere else and boom, he becomes Anthony Santander, or boom, he comes, you know, Junior Caminero or whoever, you know, that's the worst case scenario for all this. And I'm not sitting there trying to say it's always worst case scenario. My brain unfortunately does work that way sometimes, but that's what you don't want to happen. So it would be great if he can come back, stay on the field all year. Again, availability is so important, especially when you're down to one option year. And he needs to make the Guardians feel like they need to get a look at him this year. And they need to get a look at him this year, maybe either way. But, you know, hoping the best for him. I still think there's a good player in there. He is a, you know, a talent that they don't have. I would imagine he's not dissimilar to Esteban Floreal, to be honest. There's some swing and miss there. There's raw power. There's right field defense, not necessarily center field defense. I think Floreal is probably faster, might be a better athlete overall. Good arm. But there's some similarities there, and he's probably a platoon bat. So we'll see how that all goes. I think there's some similarities there, especially in those two profiles where, you know, Floreal just never had a chance and was a top prospect and it hadn't worked out. Doug Nikhazy came back on Sunday too. Good to see he's back. Only went one inning because the Rubber Ducks went into a rain delay real quickly. And yeah, he's back. That's all that's important. It was a short-term injury to that shoulder. Hopefully he's okay. Let's talk about the tugboat. Or just tugboat, I should say. I was corrected saying it's not the tugboat, it is just tugboat. Let's talk about tugboat. We didn't have a podcast last week talking about the 15 strikeout performance. Man, that was incredible. I watched that, and, you know, unfortunately, the cameras in Lynchburg, you know, all respect to our buddy Jason Prill, who's been on the show multiple times and is one of my favorite people in minor league baseball. You know, the camera angle is what it is. It's hard to really glean a whole lot watching on camera at home, but I did watch and I did listen, and it was a lot of fun. It was a great performance. He clearly was dialed in. there were some questions from the umpire and other team about the umpiring and just ball strikes. And, you know, hey, umpires at the minor league level are prospects too, and they're trying to figure it out. I think the umpires are bad at the major league level. Trust me, they are way worse than minor league level because that's why they're in the minors, right? You know, some are good, but it's just, it is what it is. The thing I want to express here, because I didn't want to take away from the guy's big day, it was a great performance. He was clearly locked in. The stuff was working. When you have a guy at the low A level, and I've talked to multiple people about this over the years, the elimination of short season ball has really hurt the quality at low A, because a lot of guys for the first time are getting to play against better competition. They're getting to play just in general for the first time. They might've been on the Arizona League circuit or Florida League circuit, whatever it was. That's not a good environment really, because you're seeing a lot of guys who are working on things that are in, everyone's working on things in the minors, but it's a lot of inexperience, and it's guys that are ramping back up from college seasons or rehabbing, whatever it is. There's a lot of circumstances that make it bad baseball. And low A is no different. The quality of pitching is terrible. So when you have prospects down there that are raw, they're not used to facing guys like Tugboat, who have three pitches, and he commands them all. He can throw them. Like, maybe there's a chance here that he has the best commands we've seen since Shane Bieber. Like, I think Tanner Bibee's a great pitching prospect. We've talked to him before on Lockdown Guardians, and Willie and I have talked about him on this podcast before, and I love Tanner as a prospect. The only thing to me holding him back from being an ace is two things: consistency right now and fastball command, which I think both he'll get to. But the reason he's not Shane Bieber yet is because Shane Bieber came out of the gate with 70 grade command. He just did. He had 70 grade command of everything. He commanded every pitch exceptionally well. Tugboat, maybe Tugboat's got the best command since Shane Bieber. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen it in person enough to sit there and say yes or no. He definitely has command enough to throw it where he wants to low A hitters. And that's frustrating because those guys are not used to, those hitters down there are used to guys who are working to command their fastball, and they hope they can throw a second pitch for a strike. Not even just command, control. That's the level of pitching at low A for the most part. You know, you get some guys here and there, but that's just the level you just don't see that a lot at. So he's facing hitters who are expecting, okay, maybe this guy can throw the fastball in the zone where he wants, and he might land an off-speed pitch for a strike. No, Tugboat can throw the fastball where he wants. He can throw the slider and the changeup where he wants in the zone and get guys to chase at low A. My tempering expectations here, though, are obviously I think everybody listening is into prospects enough to know that 15 strikeouts at any level, it's great. But it's not like you're going to say he's setting the world on fire and he's not going to continue this the rest of the levels, right? We're not sitting here saying this is going to be who he is the rest of his career. I do think he deserves a shot against high A. I think he's proven enough at this point that his stuff works against low A hitters. I don't think you need to do a whole lot in low A to prove you've beaten that level. You know, on that team right now, you have Angel Hanau and Jason Churio, who are certainly in that bucket. And last year it was the other lefty. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. The other lefty from Florida State. You know, that's those guys all proved at that level, okay? And those guys need promotions. I just want to temper expectations that Tugboat, you know, throws in the low 90s. Maybe it can get higher. Maybe he can get above the 89-92 mix. And metrically, there's nothing really that stands out about his stuff. It's really command and deception. And that can work. Maybe he is a unicorn, right? Maybe he is. We don't know. Cleveland certainly likes their unicorns. He has success against the Cape, so maybe he can do it. But I just want to temper expectations that everyone thinks this guy is the next ace, and he's got to move up quickly, and he's got to be in high A. But let's temper the expectations that, you know, this isn't, a future ace in the making. This is a guy who's a really fun prospect with a good amount of talent, probably great command, a lot of interesting things below the hood. It's just temper things just a little bit. I've seen it get a little out of hand on the internet, as that always happens. But keeping an eye on Cleo Watson and Cody Huff in Double A so far. Watson's off to a tough start offensively. It's been good. It's been up and down. the strikeouts get cut down early on. They're still kind of there. He's heading for some power. The power is just incredible. He hit a ball that was looked like it was going to go out of the stadium there a week. And now with Chase DeLauder out, he's going to get more time in the outfield, which can only be a good thing for him to me. But he's playing all over. He's playing second. He's playing third. He's playing short. He's playing outfield. That's good to see. And then Cody Huff came into this organization with, like, zero offensive expectation. He was a glove-first guy who was in low A last year, inexplicably, for Colorado. And Cleveland skipped over high A and put him in double A this year. And his OPS is, like, in the high 700s, which, again, he's 24. He's older. And we're not expecting much out of the bat. But for a guy who was skipping high A, who was in low A last year, and doesn't really have a whole lot of fans of his offensive game, after 1 month, to have a set over OPS in the high 700s, excuse me, is pretty good. So I like that. I saw Lake County on Friday against Fort Wayne, and I got to see another Trenton Denholm start. Denholm was up 93. The changeup looked good. The curveball looked good. I think he's got three good pitches. Seems to be a guy who's more of a five and fly. I don't think he has the size or the durability to really hold it up long term. So maybe he works better as a reliever, maybe like an Eli Morgan type. But I do like the pitch mix, and I think he could be like a five and fly option. He should be in double A as well. I think the innings are need to be there for him in double A. Ready to see that. I saw CJ Kafis. I like Kafis's bat. I think he makes enough contact to be pretty good. Again, I think there's some potential to have a Manzardo-ish profile there where he lifts the ball enough to the pull side to get to some power and then the contact ability. I didn't really love his approach against breaking balls. Like, he hit a double on Friday I saw off a fastball. It was a great hit. It was a smoke to the right field line. It was on an 0-2 fastball. Couldn't figure out for the life of me why Henry Baez, a Padres pitching prospect to keep an eye on, by the way, who was throwing 96-97 in the sixth inning of his final inning with good stuff. He threw him a curveball on 0-1, and Kafis swung. It was a ball. It was probably thrown 57 feet, and Kafis swung wildly at it, which I didn't expect. But then Henry Baez came back and threw a 96-mile-an-hour fastball, which, hey, Kafis caught up to. Good for him. Don't know why you would throw a guy like that a 96 fastball and an 0-2 count if he just took a big fish at your curveball in the majors and in even higher levels. That is not going to happen to Kafis, so I would watch out for that. I don't think he has the raw strength. I think you know, we talk about Manzardo not having great raw power. I don't think Kafis does either. I mean, Kafis might even be Manzardo light. Like, it might be more like 45 power, like 15 home run power. Maybe we're talking about like a platoon left field first base back, because he has played some left field and he's a little less stiff of an athlete than Manzardo. And he's greater on the bag at first base, much better defensively. So keep an eye out for that. Alex Mooney continues to find the barrel very well in Lake County. I really like his bat. He does a great job of pulling the ball and putting the ball up the middle. He can really drive it to that side. It might be a pull-heavy approach. I'd like to see him be a little more selective, but, man, when the guy gets his pitch, he barrels it. So can't blame him too much there. I think he'll handle high A just fine. I'd like to see him at double A in the second half, given that he played in the ACC last year, and the ACC, as we know, has incredible quality pitching. I'd like to see him move up. Defensively, he's like rock solid. I wouldn't say he's like a standout defender in any one position. I think he's got enough of a reaction and a glove to play third base. He has enough arm to play in the left side of the infield. He's got to be more accurate. I think his arm slots are a little bit off. I mean, he airmailed the heck out of a ball from third base on Friday that I saw just way up there. I mean, even Shaquille O'Neal wasn't catching that ball. And he's had some other throwing issues this year, I've heard, too. So not a question of strength, just a question of accuracy. I don't have a really big observation for this, so I'm just going to share. Alan Hernandez seems to be the captain's closer along with Magnus Ehlers, who throws with 96, 97, has a big arm, has trouble throwing strikes sometimes, but looks like an impressive arm overall. This is not really a baseball update besides that, but his warm-up music was 50 Cent's Many Men. That's going to earn a lot of points in the book for me. That is a quality, quality warm-up song. If you have a good warm-up or walk-up song, immediately I can grade you just a little bit higher, maybe as a prospect. Remember, Bo Naylor had Gorilla Zoe down there, and Bo Naylor right now, I think, has Soul Survivor at the Major League level. And Tyler Freeman's using Young Jock, I think, at the Major League level. But you have a good warm-up song, man. Instantly makes you just a better player. Just, I don't make the rules. That's what it is. Alex Clemmie at single A, man, it's a little concerning for me right now. Like, we're not getting the high end velocity. It's early, but he's more 93, 95. Whereas in high school, people were saying he was 97. He's not missing any bats in the last couple of outings. Obviously, we knew the control was going to be work in progress, but I'm not sitting here writing him off by any means. Obviously, it's like, you know, 4 or 5 starts into the kid's big league career. You know, by no means am I saying this just isn't it. It's not going to work. But these are all the concerns that we had when they drafted him. Is just, you know, he's a guy that has a very complicated delivery, a lot of arms and legs, and it's hard to repeat and throw strikes. And the high end stuff just isn't there right now. Maybe he'll build up to it. But these are the kind of the concerns that we had drafting him that high. And Cleveland just has a bad track record of developing high school arms. I mean, Tristan McKenzie, CeCe Sabathia, and Sam Henches are really it. That's really what it is. I'm going to go over that in a second. Arizona Complex League opened up over the weekend. Welbin Francisca was there. I know he got pulled early. I have no idea what happened there. Hopefully he's okay. I'm not sure what happened there, but a couple of guys I just like on that roster. Let's talk about overall. We've got Jose Perella is my favorite prospect in that roster. He is a 6'3", 180-pound left-handed hitter who is playing center field still, which is good. I like the swing. He can pull the ball a lot. Looks like he has a good arm out there. I really like that. Probably my favorite guy in the roster besides Welbin Francisca. Luis Marejo is still only 17 years old and had some good batted ball data we saw from Baseball America, so keep an eye on him. Pitching, Keegan Zinn, I'm looking forward to see what he can do out there. I think he was kind of a under-the-radar kind of guy they can maybe develop, taking him where they did in the 12th round. Other than that, Javier Santos, been waiting on him for a couple of years. I hope they can get him right down there. Jacob Bershanahan, same thing. I think he was an underrated late pop in the draft, too. Those are the couple pitchers I'd keep an eye on. Hoping for more from Victor Asturias. We'll see there. Yerlin Lewis was a higher-named prospect at one point, as was, I guess that guy wasn't really, no. And then Mason Bolivar had some interesting data, and Herbert Selva had some interesting years last year at the DSL. We'll see how that translates over there. Keep an eye on those guys. Okay, last week, I'm not going to share the audio. I don't have it all pulled and put together. Maybe I will in the future. But I talked to Guardians Director of Player Development, Rob Serfolio, a couple weeks ago, and we just, you know, chatted about different guys in the system, what's going on with them, and you know, where they're at. And some of the things we talked about was, obviously, they've had to, you know, change their strategy with the draft a little bit in terms of the rules of where guys can start or how many guys you can have on their roster. The big thing that stood out to me was Andrew Walters at AA. And I don't know if I shared this here or somewhere else, but the one thing they said about Andrew Walters was they had been talking to, and this is common with some prospects, not all maybe, but some of them, is that they talked to Steven Vogt about, well, hey, how would you use Andrew Walters out of the bullpen? And they'd go over scenarios about how he'd use him in different situations and different parts of the year. So they're trying to mimic everything that he would be asked to do at the major league level at AA so they can have him prepared. To me, that says he's pretty close. I think we can all agree he's going to be close anyway, but I thought that was interesting. They're already talking to Vogt about the guy who's not even on the 40-man roster, was drafted last year, about how he'd use him. So I think they're trying to get him ready for his assignment there. I wouldn't be surprised. Ross Carver and Jack Leftwich are in the bullpen officially now. It's unfortunate. Just talking about what's best for those guys right now. And right now they said, I mean, obviously they never rule anything out in the future, but that is what he said about those two guys. They are relief arms right now. I think that's what's best for them, and that's where they're going to stay. So I guess that kind of quashes my Ross Carver breakout pick for this year. But, you know, you win some, you lose some. Never going to get it all right. Ralphie Velasquez came into the year dealing with a thumb issue. I don't know what it was specifically. They obviously wasn't going to tell me what it was specifically, but that is preventing him from catching somewhat this year. So he is going to be at first base all year. He's not going to catch. you know, I don't think they're going to rule it out in the future, but you know, his bat's already taken off down there for the most part. He's learning first base. I have a hard time believing he's going to go back there, but I think throwing was part of the issue with the thumb, that he can play first base, doesn't have to throw a whole lot. They can keep him on the field batting. And I think the thumb issue was part of that. And it's just going to, you know, keep him at first base, and that's probably where it's going to go. I don't think there's any issue there. The bat was always going to do all the talking for Ralphie Velasquez. Tough news on Angel Martinez. Angel Martinez. I got to get that right. Angel Martinez. We were talking about different injuries. One guy is going to be back. You know, we talked about Valero. We talked about Cantillo, who's still a few weeks away. We also talked about Martinez, and he said Martinez, you know, they're holding out a sliver of hope that he can return by the end of the season. So it sounds like this is not going to be a short-term thing, this hamate issue. So I would not expect Angel Martinez to come back anytime soon this year. And he is going to be earning Major League service time because of when the injury happened in spring training. He hadn't been optioned down yet, so he has to be on the Major League 60-day IL. They'll get a few, if he misses most of the year, they'll get an extra option year on him, which is good, but earning Major League service time, just a very weird thing for the Guardians, the way they usually work. All right, draft stuff. The 1-1. All I can say, guys, is the bats are weird. There's like six different schools in D1, at least big time, Power 5 guys. Like West Virginia had a new single season home run record. Georgia, Oregon State, Tennessee, Florida last year with Jack. I mean, all these schools are having home run records set. If that doesn't make you seem like things are weird, then I don't know what to tell you. They're weird. They are. That being said, you know, all the discourse on Twitter is about, you know, I'm still calling it Twitter, whatever, about who to take. I think no matter what, the Guardians, I think between Bazan and Condon, both good prospects. They're both good prospects. I don't think there's going to be a wrong choice. They're both going to be good players. One thing I'll just say is the Guardians, you know, I've been joking on Twitter about taking Hagan Smith, blah, 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 because he's been great this year. And it's a very offensively powered environment right now in college, obviously. They're not going to take Hagan Smith. I'd be surprised if they did, or Chase Burns for that matter. And I think you can make a case for the Guardians never taking a first-round pitcher, truthfully, because the Guardians took Indians took CeCe Sabathia back in 98. Here's the pitchers they've taken in the first round since CeCe Sabathia in 98 that they signed. Derek Thompson didn't really go far. J.D. Martin, Dan Denham, Jeremy Guthrie, Adam Miller, Jeremy Sowers, David Huff, Alex White, Tristan McKenzie. I'm sorry, I skipped Drew Pomeranz after Alex White. Tristan McKenzie, Brady Aiken. And these are all first round, not comp, by the way. Daniel Espino, Gavin Williams, Justin Campbell. He was their comp pick. But you see what I mean? The pattern here, even if you do include the comp guys, it's rough, man. They have not done well. I mean, CeCe Sabathia, Tristan McKenzie are your best first round draft picks. Gavin Williams, hopefully, but he's not healthy right now. You know, Pomeranz and White got you Obaldo Jimenez, who was good in down the stretch in 2013. That was about it. It's bad. Jeremy Guthrie had a pretty good career after he left Cleveland, but he was really a fifth starter, not a guy who was like a 22nd overall pick type guy. They should not take a pitcher in the first round. They certainly shouldn't take a high school pitcher in the first round, as I said before. So, brutal. I've got a lot of guys I'd love to share about pitching. My one thought here for pitching is this. Obviously, this is a very good, I think this is a good college class of bats. It's top heavy in the top like eight, as Jeff and I have discussed. And then it's a really big drop off after that. But the second round guys, the third round bats are all interesting. And the pitching on the first day is brutally bad. It's not good. It's not high end. Not what you want. But if you skip to, you know, third round through fifth or sixth round, maybe in seventh round, the pitching is really interesting. There's a lot of interesting names I'd love to get into in the future. If I can have Willie back on again, we could talk about this. But after the Hagan Smiths and the Chase Burnses and the Trey Yesevages and all that, and you know, Brody Breck, even, like, there are guys in that second day, the guys I shared on Twitter that I like: Ryan Prager, Brian Holiday, Cal Steven, Aiden May, Ryan Johnson, Tristan Smith, Peyton Tolley, Aiden Major, Chase Alsop. There is an interesting class of college pitchers on day two. And that's where Cleveland makes its money, is day two of the draft. Pitching. Shane Bieber, Aaron Civale, Eli Morgan, Tanner Bibee, Logan Allen. Oh, Logan Allen, I guess, was actually day one pick? I think that was a day one pick. Either way, they make their money on pitchers after the first round. If these guys have traits they think they can improve, they can develop them. You know, you can turn a guy who might be a 4-5, you know, in college, who looks like a 4-5 pitcher. Like, Shane Bieber didn't come in with ace expectations, okay? He became an ace because they had things they could work with him on. He had 70 grade command, as we talked about. I don't know if anybody's going to have that. It just is what it is. But an Aaron Civale or a Tanner Bibee, you know, those guys came in with traits they liked. They improved their velocity. They found ways to develop them. They can make their money on those rounds with pitchers. So you can take a guy that profiles as a back of the rotation starter and maybe turn him into a 2 or 3, you know, 1 or 2 of those guys. We take 5 of them. So yeah, the pitching up front really is lacking, you know, a lot of sexiness in this class for pitching, but the college pitching in the back half of day two, the middle of day two, I think has the potential, at least for the Guardians, if they think these guys are worth working with. I don't know enough about mechanics and what they need to work with on guys, but I am interested in a lot of them. We'll talk about them in the future. So that is it for this week's episode of Guardians of the Future. I want to thank you for tuning in. Please, you know, leave a review, share with a friend if you think they would enjoy some of the top of the Guardians. Share with a friend, leave a review, somewhere you're able to give a review. All that good stuff. Subscribe on YouTube. Subscribe to your downloading on all where you can get podcasts. Appreciate all that. Maybe next time I'll do a mailbag. We might do some more draft stuff in the future. I'll try to have some people on from other affiliates again as well. Maybe next week I'll have an interview from Lake County, maybe with CJ Kafis. We'll see. Thank you for listening. I appreciate all you guys' support. Appreciate your interest in the Guardians prospect status. And hey, may the force be with you.